Welcome to the Annotated Jack. Non-productive's late to the party rewatch of Samurai Jack. It's been 15 years since Genndy Tartakovsky's groundbreaking animated series first went on the air, and in preparation for its upcoming fifth season, we're rewatching every episode of the original show.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to our Samurai Jack rewatch. This week we are talking about Samurai Jack episode 8. Jack versus Mad Jack. I'm James Carolyn, and I'm joined not at all in studio by...
Jack. We say Jack a lot in the opening of this show. There's like four Jacks per second. But I'm not Jack, I'm Frank. How are you all doing?
This episode has like three Jacks in the name.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There is. Good count. Yeah, there are a lot. This is a... I guess evil doppelganger episode, that old trope. We find our hero Jack fighting against his actually, you know what? Evil is wrong. He's not an evil doppelganger. He is a mad doppelganger. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I like this episode, and I don't. I really seem to like the beginning of the episode and the end of the episode. I think the mad Jack part of the episode is actually the part I like the least.
Really? Why is that? Why do you think that is?
You know, and this is maybe sort of my fanboy thing coming out, or my expectations of a thing make me not enjoy it. But I like that Jack is kind of a stoic character, and I guess it makes sense that his opposite, his internalness would be different. But you know, when Mad Jack comes onto the scene, he's very talky. And I didn't like that, you know. I wanted Jack's kind of evil side to also be stoic.
I think that would be way too hard to read on the screen. I mean, there's a lot. They do wonderful jobs with visual cues, the orange behind Mad Jack's eyes, and what have you, and the voice that we're given, you know. But I don't know if you could. I don't think if they were both just quietly glaring at each other would that would deliver. I think there is a lot to like about the beginning, though. I'll give you that. What I want to talk about right off the bat is the Mos Eisley scene, right? And Mos Eisley totally. In general. So Mos Eisley, the scene in the original Star Wars, it's super iconic. It sets the stage for a whole ton of sci-fi and fantasy. In itself, it's informed by a bunch of things that came before it. But what it really does really well in Star Wars is establish that this is a really big universe that we're about to play in. There are a bunch of different aliens out there. There's a bunch of culture there kind of all tied up. The fact that you've got a bunch of weird aliens and they're all together and no one's going, that's an alien, it informs a lot of the audience. And that works the same way in this, probably our second major cantina scene. We've had bazaars, we've had taverns, we've had bars. But in that first episode arc, when Jack first shows up in the future, and here even more so, this is just a bunch of scumbag alien bounty hunters hanging around, causing trouble, and all Jack wants is some hot water for his tea. And I think it establishes a lot right off the bat. And I love the shorthand that this show uses with an audience that it just sort of assumes is going to be genre savvy, which is, you know, interesting because it was originally this cartoon was aimed at kids who are not necessarily as genre savvy as, you know, like middle-aged geeks.
Right. No, I love how this scene kind of harkens back to Star Wars and the things we love about Star Wars, as you said. You know, I'm watching it with Katie, and Katie's the first thing she mentions is how much that scene reminds her of Star Wars. I think you really hit the nail on the head there. I'll bring up a fun factoid. The music they're playing for this scene that's being played on the jukebox or jukebox-like thing is a song called Soul Bossa Nova. And if you recognized it, it's because it's also the classical piece that was adapted into the Austin Powers theme.
Oh, Lord.
The do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
All right.
So that's a fun tidbit.
I did not notice. I did not know that. Now that you doo-doo it in my ear, I could definitely hear it. That's interesting. The mace dance is on point. That one alien with the mace dance, beautiful. beautiful. And of course, we
I love also how when we go right into the kind of in the same way you said how this kind of harkens to such a larger universe. I love how they kind of follow that theme through into Jack's confrontation with a couple of different bounty hunters. Mm-hmm. You have the one that looks like Chewbacca,
right,
but then
right,
you have
right into
like
the Star Wars thing. Right.
Yeah, the fuzzy ball thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get the monkey thing with the paws that come out. You have the guy who's riding the like robotic elephant who's kind of like an Australian hunter. Like they give such a broad stroke of like how many people could actually be looking for Jack and how many enemies he's going to have to come up against. I think it's just really cool and really satisfying. And it does some of that cool stuff that Samurai Jack does when he fights. And then I just love how satisfied I am at the end when he just screams out, "Who else wants some?" You know?
Yeah. I agree. These are a fun chain of battles. So one thing I want to go back to these fights for a particular thing. So again, it's like when you think about who the audience of Samurai Jack is or was, it's confusing in that. All right, so like I was fully grown by the time I first watched Samurai Jack, and I noticed all the little hints and the throwbacks and the suggestions and the references that they were using in all the design for these creatures. You've got that monkey thing with the robotic finger that's like a tentacle. There was like five or six villains from 80s cartoons that inexplicably had like extendo limbs. As if that were like a thing that made them more frightening, whether it was fingertips or hands or necks, just like these mechanical limbs that would just stretch out at you, which, you know, is not the most intimidating thing in the world, but it was a trope at the time for these cartoons. And this thing is hitting on, and this like this series of battles hits on all of them. I find it interesting that you think that the big game hunter was Australian, because that's what I thought of at first too, but then I rethought it. I'm like, no, he's a lion. There's a Russian bear, which is, you know, a pretty point-on stereotype.
He was a lion.
And I think
he's
actually an African big game hunter.
I guess an African big game hunter. You know,
he's on an elephant.
So I say he's Australian because he's actually a character.
Right.
That's a cameo from Hunter, spelled with a U. It's a Dexter's Lab character.
Yeah, from Dial M for Monkey.
In Dexter's Lab, I'm pretty sure he has an Australian sort of accent going on.
And if you look at his hat, it does have that kind of. There are subtle people who are more aware of big game hunter hats will tell you that kind of like folded thing was probably the cue for us to think big game hunter rather than or Australian rather than African big game hunter. But that's pretty awesome that they managed to sneak in a Dexter's Lab reference in the middle of this thing. I very much was excited by that.
As you were talking about referencing back to other cartoons, the line "Who else wants some" is actually a line that is used in two other episodes that Gendry Tavowski was involved in. It's at the end of the dodgeball episode of Dexter's Lab when Dexter defeats all his opponents in dodgeball. It's also in the episode of the Powerpuff Girls Bubblevacious. There's a big Bubbles is in a big training program, and after she defeats it, she also exclaims, "Who else wants some?"
Yeah, I read those two trivia facts too. I'm not sure how much. I mean, definitely it's in work he's done, but it's also like super iconic on its own. Just a guy
true.
Who goes through hell and just scream like the fact that the "who wants some" is my like is the best thing to shout out after a chain of getting your ass beat for no reason, and then it like following it up with the sandal snap, like it's perfect. You get like it's what you don't need exposition to explain if you have good voice acting and good direction. That snap was like his mind snapping, and it's perfect. I really did enjoy that. It was like one of my favorite scenes from the entire episode. I also want to talk a little bit about sound design. We've discussed this on the show in the past, but when there are elements where when everything kind of calms down and gets really tense, and then there's like a release, and then suddenly you don't hear the background music anymore. You hear birds chirping in the woods. Everything is just sort of it's the quiet before the storm, before Mad Jack shows up. And again, when he's battling Mad Jack and eventually decides what to do and what he should be doing, when it's Jack, it's the quiet serenity of the forest, the birds chirping, and Mad Jack, it's, you know, tempo and music and violence and anger. The sound design is wonderful in this program.
It's funny, too, because I feel like most people, when they think of Samurai Jack, you know, like nostalgically, they're like, oh, man, Samurai Jack is such a cool visual style. But I mean, I agree with you, Frank. I feel like the more we watch, the more impressed I am with just how much detail is put into the sound design. Mm-hmm. Contrarily, a thought I had while we were watching the other day was how I almost wish I was watching this show on a 4:3 television. You know, the show, particularly in the fight with Jack versus Mad Jack, really loves to play with aspect ratios. And since the show was originally done in 4:3, I'm wondering if I'm losing some of that intended, that artist intended vision by taking the screen from a 4:3 to a 16:9 to a 16:10 to like a couple of individual boxes inside of a 4:3. I mean, it really loves to play with aspect ratio and with negative space in a way that is really interesting. And I almost feel like I'm missing out by having these two big black bars on the side when I'm watching.
That's a very interesting point I hadn't thought about. But yeah, the negative space used to frame the shots is definitely part of, in the same way the sound design, the silence is sometimes telling part of the story. I'm sure we're getting a strange new version of Samurai Jack 15 years later. Huh. Well, just to wrap it up on that final battle with Mad Jack, I appreciate that. I think a character like Jack, you can easily dismiss or forget the nature of his stoicism, the nature of his inner peace and his mission, simply because silence, you know, it doesn't speak very loudly. You won't hear him repeating over and over again how he's unlike other heroes because it's not all about violence for him. And I think this was a good way of showing it, what Jack could be. And the reflection of himself as just as crazed and enraged as his mad version in his own sword, both underlines this is a magic sword. It underlines that our hero is a peaceful man. It underlines the fact that that violence is not the solution for everything. I think it's whether or not you enjoyed the battle itself, which I actually did enjoy, I think it was a very good message to leave us off on. And I think overall, like, a pretty solid episode, even though it's just a bunch of mook battles and a mirror fight.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Really solid episode. I think I feel like the mirror fight is less solid. I don't know why. I just don't love it as much as I honestly enjoyed the mook battles at the beginning. I think it ends on a really great note. I love kind of Jack, you know, looking up at the sky or talking to the nothing, saying, I know you're watching and that these tricks are getting old. I mean, it's certainly a welcome change from the past couple of episodes where Jack has, you know, given up another way to go home. This is more of kind of like a, you know, I know you're there, Aku, but, you know, I don't give no Fs, you know?
Right. And I think it's interesting to see Aku at least legitimately upset or worried about Jack and his progression and his quest. Because so far, Aku's been nothing but win, win, win. And it's he's sitting there, or looming there, watching his little portal, following Jack, putting money out on his head. It's It's a tough thing, and I think it's a well placed episode in the story arc. So pretty cool. I'm excited for the next episode.
I feel like Aku really hasn't won, right? So Jack has thwarted Aku, maybe Aku has not been able to kill Jack, but Jack has helped numerous people escape Aku's oppression and has literally changed kind of the landscape of small areas in which Aku's rule exists. So Jack, while Aku has not been able to kill or murder Jack, I feel like Jack, despite not getting home, has done more damage and effect to Aku's regime or universe than he has, you know, by just going back in time, if that makes any sense.
I think you're absolutely right, but I also think, like, it's hard to see that from the big picture when you're watching cartoons. Like, you want to believe that, well, the hero wins when the hero wins, or the hero kicks the bad guy's butt. You forget that the, you know, freeing oppressed people is a win, or at least I did. So, interesting. So, do you happen to know what episode is next? I wait with bated breath.
The next episode is episode 9, Jack Under the Sea.
All right, so I'm not
under
sure.
Under the Sea.
Stop it. Don't sing. I'm not sure if this is the one or not, but if this episode made me nostalgic, or not even nostalgic, made me thirsty for tea, this next episode is one of my all-time favorites, just for the set dressing of what Jack is hungry for.
Well, I am very excited, and we will chat about that one next week.
Yeah.